Welcome, everybody. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm director of the Africa program here at CSIS. Before I introduce this panel, I just want to give a heads up on a couple of shameless pitch for a couple of other events that we're having in the coming week. Tomorrow evening, from 5 to 6:30, we're going to launch a CSIS publication on Africa policy in the Bush years, critical choices for the Obama administration. We'll have an informal reception beginning at 5. I think a number of senior people from the current and the previous administration will be there. Johnny Carson will give kind of opening, very informal remarks. We'll have a roundtable led by our team of authors and chaired by Chet Crocker. So that should be a fun, fairly informal event to launch that. On Monday, June 15th, from 2 to 4, we have Chief Ufot-Ekete, the Minister for Niger Delta Affairs, coming to speak on efforts in the Niger Delta with Stephen Davis, who's just written of Coventry Cathedral, who's just come out with a paper on kind of framing a way forward on the Niger Delta, offering as a discussant. Finally, from the other coast of Africa, we have next week on the 16th, we'll host a session on Kenya with Martha Karua, Paul Mwite, and Makau Matua, coming to talk about kind of some of the intra-elite politics and intra-Kikuyu politics in particular within Kenya. So I wanted to give you a heads up on those events. And if you haven't received an invitation, just please let us know and we'll make sure to get you a notice. But today, Nigeria, and we're delighted to have with us today Nasir El-Rufai and Carl Levan of American University as a discussant. You have bios in front of you. As you know, Nasir was minister of the Nigerian Federal Capital Territory. He was a member of the Reform Dream Team under the Obasanjo administration, along with his colleague Nuhum Rubato, who is here with us today as well. And I hope you'll feel free to pipe up during this discussion. And you might want to talk a bit more about your more recent history. Nuhu had left Nigeria, joined, and has been at Harvard University since, has come under challenge from the EFCC, which he and Nuhu Rubato were instrumental in creating and making an instrument of investigation and into corruption. And more recently has had fairly harsh words for the Yar'Adua administration that have provoked a considerable response in the Nigerian press. I think today, though, we want to look really more at the broad political dynamics within Nigeria, kind of what are driving what's happening there, what are the prospects for reform, the reform efforts, even with the dream team assembled on the Obasanjo administration, came up against fairly difficult obstacles. I think that those obstacles are still there. What is it going to take, I think, to make some of those more viable? And so we're looking forward to your remarks. And we've asked Carl Levan, who's done a great deal of work on Nigeria. He's an assistant professor at American University in the School of International Service. He's done a lot of work on the Niger Delta, but also on political dynamics within Nigeria more broadly. He's currently writing a book about government performance in Nigeria since independence, but I think he might be an old man before that gets finished. It's a long story. With that, I think we'll open up, and you'll speak, and we want to leave ample time at the end for interaction and questions and comments. So welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jennifer, Carl. I want to first thank Jennifer and the Center for inviting me and giving me this opportunity. The last time I was here was 1st of November, I remember clearly, to speak to Jennifer, because at that time I was thinking of establishing a policy advocacy think tank in Nigeria. Of course, things have changed a lot since then, and that is no longer my priority. But what I want to spend a few minutes to speak about today is our experience in implementing economic reforms in Nigeria. And after 2 years of being out of government and having the chance to look from outside in, I've come to certain conclusions about what we missed. And I think that some of these conclusions perhaps may help shape thinking about designing and implementing economic reforms and indeed other reforms in Nigeria and the rest of Africa. I also want to propose in my remarks that focusing on economic reforms was the led to the ultimate lack of sustainability of the reforms, because I think that economic reforms without political reforms leads to very poor outcomes. And one of the conclusions I've come to in the last 2 years, being at the Kennedy School and elsewhere, is that politics is far more important than economics. If you don't get the politics right, you probably get everything else wrong. And the experience of Nigeria, I think, is proof of that. I'm not going to go through my remarks in great detail, because you have that and it's short enough for you to all have gone through. So what I will try to do is to summarize key aspects of the remarks, making the key points, but dwelling more generally on the challenges of reform in countries like Nigeria, as well as spend some time on the political dynamics within Nigeria, because I've been around, I've lived in Nigeria all my life, nearly 50 years. But more importantly, I've been in government in the 9 years before 2007. And the challenges that Nigeria faces going forward are quite similar to the challenges faced by many African countries and developing countries. What is unique about Nigeria is that it is so big and so important. At least Nigerians think so. And because we supply a large percentage of the oil that this economy needs to move forward, I think the U.S. government also thinks so. And this is reflected by the extent of interaction between Nigerian delegations visiting Washington. I'm sure this center has hosted many, and as we've heard, is going to host even more. So let me step back and propose what I'm going to say. But I will start with a question. President Obama is going to visit Africa again, because Egypt is Africa, by the way. It's not, we consider it part of the African continent, not the Middle East. But his first visit to sub-Saharan Africa will be to Ghana. And as a Nigerian, that upsets me a lot. But I understand why. The White House issued a statement that President Obama was visiting Ghana to showcase good governance and support for vibrant civil society. If those indeed were the criteria, rather than size and economic importance and so on, then of course Ghana is the right choice. And I think this was a clear message to the leadership in Nigeria. And Nigerians, through the media and civil society, I think got the message from President Obama, which is, you may be big, you may be rich, or you may have a lot of oil, unless you get your act together, unless you govern yourselves better, no one is going to take you seriously. And for many of us, for me personally, and for Nuhu Ribadu, and many of us in the Obasanjo economic team, the fact that this positive trajectory that Nigeria has achieved up to 2007 has suddenly changed is really a tragedy, and we are saddened by it. But it is also the reality, and I think all we can do is to learn from it and move forward. I don't need to spend time talking to you about Nigeria, but to say that it is the largest country in the continent. One out of every 45 human beings is a Nigerian. One out of every 5 or 6 Africans. So it is an important country, and my professor at the Kennedy School, Rodberg, believes, and he wrote a paper to the Council on Foreign Relations just before our elections in 2007, that Nigeria should be a Central African question. I'm reading from what he wrote. No country's fate is so decisive for the African continent. And no other country across a range of issues has the power to so thoroughly shape outcomes elsewhere in sub-Saharan Africa. He concluded by saying that if Nigeria works well, so might Africa. And this is a great burden on us as Nigerians. And when we were in government, you know, this was something that we remembered constantly. And we took very hard and difficult decisions to try to change the negative views of Nigeria. And I think that the results were clear. The economy grew, the investments grew, every measure of economic performance showed a positive upward trend. And at the end of the day, that is what is important, that the people of Nigeria were beginning to see hope, that things were changing for the better. But since then, things have changed slightly for the worse. And I've spent the last 2 years asking myself, why? What did we go wrong? And part of what I concluded we did wrong was, I think we did not define reform very, very comprehensively. The focus of most bilateral and multilateral agencies is to insist on economic reform, and many governments in Africa and elsewhere did this throughout the 90s, the days of Washington Consensus and so on. Economic reform has been very useful in stabilizing Africa's macroeconomy, but has not done much more than that, quite frankly. Reflecting now, I would like to redefine reform to include not just economic reform, but political reform. Because in my view, as reformers in the previous administration, we made at least two big mistakes. The first was that we failed to appreciate that the political leadership we worked with never really bought into the reforms as such, but accepted them only out of necessity. Okay, the political elite just accepted these reforms out of necessity. In the case of President Obasanjo, for instance, he wanted to get Nigeria's $30 billion Paris Club debt written off, and he was prepared to accept anything that will lead to that conclusion. And I think that was why he tolerated some of the steps we took to get to that point. And we did. By 2005, we had persuaded the Paris Club and bilateral donors led by the UK that we deserved debt relief. Lots of actions were taken, from Nuhu Ribadu's work in curbing corruption to introducing procurement reforms to privatization and so on and so forth. So this was the necessity bit, and I think whenever you look at reforms, you will see this going through all for each country. Secondly, as members of the reform team, we kept insisting that we're technocrats, we're there to just do the job and get out. Apart from Ribadu, who was a career public servant, all of us came from outside. I came from the private sector, Bode Augusto from the private sector, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala and Obi came from here, Ngozi from the World Bank and Obi from the Kennedy School. So we kept insisting that we are not politicians, we are not interested in politics, and we were just in government to do a short-term job. And the politicians decided that it was best to wait patiently and wait us out. After all, we are technocrats who will do what we could and leave, and then they can take charge and reverse everything. You know, we didn't see that then, but now, on reflection, I could see that they were just smiling at us and saying, okay, you know, you have your way for now, and at the end, we'll have a final say. And for people as clever as Ngozi and Obi and so on, not to realize that politics trumps everything, I think was a big mistake. And looking through all efforts at economic reform throughout Africa, you'll see this threat. A few of the technocrats have made the transition to contest for public office, but only if you have been successful. And this is why I feel very strongly now more than ever that whenever reforms are being designed, they should not be focused unduly on economics. They should focus on overall governance. They should focus on outcomes that deliver services to the people, and sometimes that requires being deeply involved in politics and listening to the politicians. This approach of technocrats, insulated from everything else, I don't think is enough. In fact, with the benefit of hindsight, I would say perhaps equal or more effort should have been invested in political reforms. So that's one. That's one area where we have failed. And because we didn't get involved in politics, because we didn't interact intensively enough with the politicians, I think we were unable to get the incoming administration to buy into the economic reforms we started, or indeed, build on what was done. I think they sort of just agreed that this was fine, we will support this, we'll do this, but when they got political power, they began to implement their own agenda. And what has happened in the Yar'Adua administration is just a series of reversals of virtually everything. Since this administration came into office, there has been no privatization at all. Nothing has been sold. In fact, privatization that have been done have been investigated, and technical provisions in the share purchase agreements have been invoked to actually cancel or reverse some of them, which is quite worrying for a country like Nigeria that invested a lot of effort to persuade investors, both foreign and domestic, to actually put their money in the country. And I can go on and on to show that many of these reforms have either stagnated or reversed, and certainly not going forward. And this is not typical of Nigeria alone, but you see it around some of the biggest countries in the continent. The where the Yar'Adua government, I think, is unique is that it is reversing and suspending and stagnating what has been started, but does not seem to have a clear alternative agenda of its own. Maybe because there is really no alternative. I mean, today, what every nation needs to do to move forward is to compete with other nations for everything from attracting investments to the best people. And quite frankly, you cannot do so unless you continue on that trajectory. In addition, the administration has embarked on a program of criminalizing all those that participated in reforms in the past. Nuhu Ribadu is an example of that. He was doing his job so well that twice there are attempts to assassinate him, and he had to leave the country and has been a visiting fellow at CGD and Oxford University since then. I have gone through a similar line of attack, but slightly different because I was out of the country. But the whole idea is to try to show that we were not committed reformers, but some clever criminals that were doing things that were wrong and were just too clever, and now we're being exposed and so on. And virtually all of us except one have left the country, either voluntarily or some kind of self-imposed exile. And this is not new in Africa. Any alternative voice in many African countries is silenced by threats of being charged for treason or sedition or being accused of corruption if you've served in government. And this has been going on. But what is the reality? The reality is that since beginning in early 2008, it seems that the political elite of Nigeria, which historically has depended on taking power for their benefits, have become stronger and stronger in Nigeria. Some of the people that were charged, that were indicted and charged for corruption, before courts of law by the EFCC, for instance, are now the most influential people in the country. So the tables have turned. And this is a cause for concern. But what is also of greater concern is the fact that the political goods which every society is entitled to under a government are not being delivered in Nigeria. Here I'm talking about security, rule of law, free and open participation in the political process, and so on and so forth. So I feel, quite frankly, you know, based on what we have seen in Nigeria, that the most important, and this may be obvious to many people, the most important variable that makes or breaks a country, particularly African countries with weak institutions, is the quality of leadership, usually depending on just one man. I know there are all kinds of theories about the African big man and all that, but it is not necessarily a good thing. But remember, we are in a continent that have young nations that were cobbled together by accidents of history. And many of these countries have not had the opportunity to have one constitution for a long time or build institutions over time. Usually, building these institutions requires good leadership being there to create and nurture these institutions and hand them over from generation to generation. This has not happened in Africa. After independence, we became an arena for the Cold War, military interventions, all kinds of stuff have gone on in the continent. So in many African countries, except a handful, you know, Botswana, Mauritius, South Africa, there are very weak institutions. So often, what one or two or three people decide determines the fate of the continent. And nowhere is this more evident than Nigeria, where within a matter of 2 years, so much has changed in the country. And most of the people that were in government in 2007 are still in government. The civil service is the same. The political party is the same party that won the elections with all the flaws and the problems. It was just changing a handful of people that has brought about this remarkable schism. So effective results-oriented leadership is vital for Nigeria's progress, and indeed for any country. And when we have a leadership that is committed and beholden to the people, then you get results. I'm here referring to whether elections matter or not, because unless you have a situation in which when people vote, the votes are actually counted, the results recorded and announced, the incentive to vote on the part of the voters, as well as the incentive to behave well on the part of the politicians, are absent. So you have a double disincentive when you do not have clean elections. And that is my first recommendation as Nigeria's number one priority, that we must implement electoral reforms. We must all stand up as Nigerians and as Africans to insist that what we have seen in Ghana, as an example, repeats itself, not only in Nigeria, but all over the continent. The President Yar'Adua had admitted in his inaugural speech that his election was flawed and he would set up a blue ribbon commission to look at the problems and make recommendations. They have done so. They have made very wide and far-reaching recommendations, which, if implemented, will go a long way in making the votes of Nigerians matter. And I think every Nigerian and all friends of Nigeria must be very vocal in making that this happens. And those that can speak below the radar should also do so, because there are many ways to persuade. But this is vital. This is the most important reform, and it's not economic, again, that I think will enable Nigerians to resolve their problems in the long run. Because the biggest challenge, I think, in Nigeria today is the disconnection between the governed and the voters. the Electoral Commission and the political elite just sit down and write the results and announce a winner and wait for tribunals to decide, whether you have won or not. And one third of all the elections, the governorship elections, were cancelled and had to be rerun. This is an indication of the gravity of the problem. The second is that Nigeria and many African countries lack the most basic infrastructure. Electricity is almost non-existent in the country. When we left office, we were generating 3,200 megawatts for a population of 150 million. South Africa was generating 45,000 megawatts for a population of about 40 million, and they still had shortages. So this really is an indication of the crisis in Nigeria with regards to electricity. And unless we have electricity, really nothing else can move. Among the infrastructures, I pick out electricity because it is so vital, and it is what every Nigerian complains about. We are the leading producer of oil in Africa, not the exporter anymore because Angola has overtaken us. But constantly in Nigeria, our people have to withstand long queues just to buy gasoline. And it is sad. It is quite sad that we import 80% of our refined product needs, yet we still have queues. These are small steps that can really ease the life of the people of Nigeria and make a difference, because Nigerians are natural entrepreneurs. All they need is a little help from the government to give them basic things. They can really take care of themselves. The third important issue, of course, is resolving the Niger Delta problem. This is a 50-year-old problem. Successive governments of Nigeria have failed the people of the Niger Delta, where a large percentage of the country's natural resources income comes from. The Niger Delta problem is a complex one. There are no technical solutions, and there is no solution that would be implemented that would satisfy everyone. Many of us in Nigeria have always known that military intervention may be necessary at some point in the Niger Delta. Now, whether the current intervention is appropriate or not, I do not have enough information to comment on that. But we all knew at some point military intervention will be necessary. But before then, there should be extensive dialogue. President Yar'Adua promised to have a stakeholder conference. It has not taken place in 2 years. And I think it is vital not to skim over the surface, but to go to the fundamental roots of the problem and try to address them in an honest and just manner. And I'm not sure that is being done. So I don't want to come with a very long list, but I think that for Nigeria, these three are key. I will recapitulate again. Electoral reform, investments in key infrastructure, particularly electricity, and hydrocarbons, and then resolving the Niger Delta problem. And I do think that, we need to keep talking about this and keep reminding our leadership to do so. So let me conclude, ladies and gentlemen, by summarizing my message to this audience. First, I think we should not accept repetitive statements that suggest that the status quo in Nigeria is sustainable. It is not. A system of governance where the ruling elite continue to wield authority for their own personal enrichment and benefit is not sustainable in the long run. There are enough examples in history to know that that won't work. Nigeria's future, therefore, lies in its ability to focus on these three priorities and strengthening the institutions of governance so that there are real checks and balance on authority. And I think this is where the international community can engage with Nigeria. Now, Nigeria is not the typical African country that is dependent on aid. So you cannot use aid policy or interventions, with credits from the World Bank to influence Nigeria. Nigeria can pretty much take care of itself financially. But what Nigerians expect, what Nigerian officials expect, and I was one, so I can speak for them, they expect to be taken seriously in international fora. We consider ourselves the most important country in the continent, and we deserve that respect. We expect to be invited to G8 meetings, G20 meetings, and once in a while, you know, come to Washington and visit the president of the U.S., among others. If good governance is tied to this recognition in this international fora, it will help change governmental behavior more than anything. I just give this as an example. But at the end of the day, as I said, friends of Nigeria can only help so much. Nigerians will have to take their destiny into their own hands. And as I was writing these remarks, I came across an article in the New York Times where Thomas Friedman talked about Iraq. And that was, and I thought that it referred to Nigeria so precisely. Now, it was about Iraq, but he said that ultimately which way Iraq goes will depend on whether the ruling elite decide to use their freedom to loot their country or to rebuild it. And I think at the end of the day, that is the choice before the Nigerian ruling elites. But all of you, all of us, can play our contributory roles. I hope that during the question and answer session, we'll go into some detail in any areas that may be of interest to you. But thank you for listening.
My remarks will be fairly limited. I was brought in late into the game, but I'm delighted to be here. And I want to begin with a few historical frames. First is that during my own introduction to Nigeria in 1999 and 2000, I was part of a fascinating meeting with Transparency in Nigeria in 2000 and a group of 15 civil society organizations that were involved in anti-corruption reform. And one of the climactic debates of the conference they were having was, should chieftaincy be recognized as a bribe? If a current politician is offered a chieftaincy title, does this constitute a bribe? And there was this wonderful debate that educated me in the most profound way about Africa. And Peter Eke, a Nigerian sociologist, wrote about this almost 30 years ago in a classic piece. And he wrote about Africans having two separate publics and struggling with the civic public because it was foreign and it was part of a state which had grown out of colonialism and had not grown organically. What's interesting about that for us today is that he was concerned about public perceptions and about the civic perception and mass public opinion and how they saw the state. And this is the first of what phenomena that I'm going to describe, which has really flipped around in Nigeria's very recent history. Now, the problem between what is public and what is private is much more focused on those who hold political power. So in other words, the public is largely on board, and now we're in a situation where we need to bring the politicians along a great deal more. The Transparency International measure of what public perceptions are of Nigerian corruption have actually improved in the last year or two. You know, perhaps there is a little bit of a lag in these kinds of perceptions, because I don't want to put that out there in order to discount Mr. El-Rufai's comments about the pace of reform since 2007, which is absolutely something to be concerned about. But this brings me to another recent historical frame of reference for me, which is in 2000 when I first met you, which was at a meeting of the House and Senate Privatization Committees when they were drafting legislation to monitor and to guide the privatization process. This is another example, and perhaps a more specific example, which I think which came to my mind in listening to your remarks, because at that time, 10 years ago, the politicians were trying to convince the economists that politics were relevant. And in listening to you today, now I feel like I'm hearing the economists out there trying to convince the politicians that political reform matters and that politics are relevant. So this is a very important change of terms of reference for Nigeria, and frankly something that I think it can learn a great deal from comparatively, looking at some of the struggles that occurred in Latin America and in many other parts of the world when they were grappling with this relationship between political reform, democratization, and economics and liberalization, should people choose liberalization. And so that brings me to the reforms. And one thing that I think is a really important principle is to think about reforms and the relationship between outcomes and process. And when you talk about infrastructure, you're very focused on obtaining specific outcomes. And as an outsider and as a social scientist, when I hear that in Africa, I get nervous. And I get nervous because, for me, democracy is ultimately so focused on process. And I think that you're being perfectly fair that you are committed to reform and to democratizing a democratic process even further, deepening Nigeria's democracy. Within Nigeria, the relationship between economic and politics and the reforms, from my own research, really began in the 1980s, where a civil society that up till then had previously not thought about goals in universalistic terms, had not built coalitions across issues, emerged largely because of opposition to economic reform. And so this is very much the story of civil rights and civil liberties and organizations working on human rights in Nigeria. And those were all reforms that I think were ultimately focused on process. And now we're looking 20 years later at where Nigeria is and how it thinks about process and what are the two or three or four or five stages beyond that initial birth of a democratic movement in Nigeria, modern Nigeria. Secondly, is that debt is political. And you mentioned the Obasanjo administration's focus on paying off the debt. And I've talked about that effort as being as much a political strategy as an economic policy. When Nigeria paid off that debt, it radically changed the mutual perception of Nigerians, of the West, and it has only started to begin to change the Western perception of Nigeria. So Nigeria is very much ahead of the West in that regard. And I think that one potential example of how Nigeria is capitalizing on this leverage is the country's great public aversion to any kind of international involvement in the Niger Delta. So when that debt was paid off, I think that that was arguably as much a part of a political strategy as it was an economic policy, because it gave the Nigerian government so much more latitude in its policy options. So debt is ultimately political. So now that debt has been relieved and there have been some ups and downs over the last 10 years, one of the key issues, I think, for political reform in thinking through this economic relationship is, can political reform move Nigeria towards a new kind of comparative advantage in the global economy? So with that in mind, I really took to heart your comment about no technical solution to the Niger Delta problem. I couldn't agree with you more on that specific and really critical point, because that is exactly where virtually every Niger Delta technical commission for the last 50 years has ended up. With a technical solution, trying to insulate the solution from politics somehow, which then only reopens up once there's been any kind of government change or regime change a few years later. So what kind of political reform can move Nigeria towards the roots of a new comparative advantage within the global economy? because in the Western world, what Ronald Engelhardt has called countries within the post-material sphere, oil revenue is going to decline. It's probably not going to take a few years. It's probably going to take more than a few years. But oil, demand for oil is slowly going to decline. And I know about China and all this sort of thing, and we can talk about that. But the use of oil and the perception of oil is changing in very important ways. And so in Nigeria's long-term self-image, I think it needs to think through very critically what its next steps are. With that in mind, I think that the decline in oil prices, the radical drop in oil prices in the last year or two, has surprised some of us who watch the political economy of Nigeria generally and the Niger Delta in particular. One of the things we had always debated is whether a decline in oil prices would make the militants in the region more desperate. And I would suggest, and again, this is open for debate, but I would suggest that actually what has happened is that the decline in oil prices has arguably made the government a bit more desperate. And I think that describes some of the militancy on the part of the government in the last month or two, which I think almost always backfires in these kinds of struggles. I mean, we can go back quite far into world history, into these kinds of situations of secession or quasi-secession. So I think that this is a really wonderful introduction to where Nigeria is today and this relationship between economic reform and political reform. And I also could not hope to emphasize more the importance of electoral reform in this whole process, which you listed as one of your key three recommendations, because that is what has been missing from, I think, the way the country has approached anti-corruption work, is to not situate anti-corruption work within this larger framework of fair and vigorous political competition, which ultimately contributes to a climate of accountability. In other words, it must be risky for people who engage in corruption to engage in corruption. And political competition and transparency are our best guarantees for getting us there. And so in that regard, electoral reform is absolutely essential. And there are some other narrow technical issues, which I suspect we may get into in the question and answer about the authorities of the EFCC and the Independent Commission as well. But I would like to talk about those if we have time, and I think they're worth talking about. So I hope that that's fulfills my duties. And I'm very grateful for this opportunity. So I've been coming to CSIS for a number of years, and Jennifer Cook and I have gotten to know each other better lately, and I'm happy to be here. So
yeah,
thank you.
That's great. Thank you, Carl. That's terrific. Why don't we open up for questions? I mean, I wanted to start with how the question of how do you get to the political reform? I mean, you talk about this kind of sharp break between the Obasanjo administration and the Yar'Adua administration. But, the elections, for example, were essentially orchestrated by the Obasanjo administration and the bid for the third term and so forth. And to kind of rely on a political leader to have that vision seems a lot to ask when the process, when perhaps the process doesn't always mean that the most visionary rises to the top. And how are you going to get... And I think a lot of the efforts of Ngozi and yourselves and others really, as in the run-up to the election, were essentially scuttled, and Ngozi left early on. As you begin to be more successful in the reform efforts, you're always going to hit up against that wall of resistance from vested interests, and that becomes even more intense in an electoral cycle. So I wonder why that... Maybe you can respond to that, but why don't we open and take a few at a time? And as I said, you're always welcome to pipe in at any moment. Ed, and then Hank, and then we'll go here.
uh, Thank you. Very complicated. I actually wanted had a similar question to Jennifer's, but take it a step farther. Thank you, Mr. Overfy and Nuhu, for being here. But the implication, my question is, how do you get to the point of electoral reform and the kind of political competition that Carl was talking about? The implication, one implication of what you have said, might be that the political elite will stymie electoral reform as well. So how do you get past that roadblock? Short of a revolution, is the only avenue to simply build a bigger middle class and foment competition among the political elite? I assume the political elite in Nigeria is not quite as monolithic as you may have implied. Would appreciate your comments.
Good morning. I'm Herman Cohen, a retired diplomat. And now my main focus is on electricity in Africa from the private sector point of view, private investment in electricity. And I've been following this in Nigeria ever since Obasanjo took office, where everyone's rhetoric was promising more electricity. And now after all these years, there's less electricity. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of gas. There's a very good entrepreneur named Naji who has built a 300-megawatt power plant in eastern Nigeria, and there's no gas. Who is blocking the development of electricity? There must be some vested interest in having no electricity. Who is it, and who's doing it?
Thank you. Let me start with political reform. Political reform is very difficult when its implementation will lead to incumbents being booted out of office. And because everything in countries like Nigeria, from access to resources to prestige, is tied to holding political office, that is very difficult. It takes a lot of courage and vision on the part of an incumbent political leader to implement reforms that will arguably, lead to the person being voted out. And that is why I believe that this is not something that will be resolved in one election cycle. I think that if we are able to get the electoral reforms recommended by the UWAIS committee to be implemented, we will begin to see the change. Let me share an anecdote here, because in contradistinction to the other members of the economic team, I was running a territory. So I had to oversee elections in Abuja. It's the smallest part of Nigeria, so the level of political competition in Abuja was not as intense. We don't have a governor, we have one senator, we have two House of Reps members, very similar to the status of Washington, D.C., just a little better. but at that time, we had done polls that indicated that the ruling party was going to win the elections overall, the presidential elections. And the polls indicated that we were going to lose in Abuja. And that was very troubling for members of the ruling party. How could we lose the elections in the nation's capital? So I was under considerable pressure to do something. What I did was to invite the political parties, meet with them, and say that, we will not tolerate any kind of malpractice, and anyone that was caught doing anything will not be handed over to the police, but handed over to the dreaded EFCC. Because my argument then was, if you are involved in electoral manipulation, you must have been given money, so you can be charged for money laundering. I was not going to get anyone charged for electoral offenses, which were non-existent in our books, by the way, until the new electoral reform bill. But we'll charge you for money laundering, and nobody wanted Nuribadu to be near his, So we had fairly decent elections in Abuja, and we lost. Okay, the opposition party won. Now, I was able to do that because I was not contesting, I had no interest, and I saw myself as a technocrat, which was foolish. now after the fact. But it is difficult. I think it requires a lot of persuasion and education and the involvement of Nigerians. But what I recommend from this side of the table is that the only way we can get electoral reform, political reform in Nigeria is start with electoral reform. Let the votes matter. And one of the ways this can be done is domestically we create a movement, a huge political movement, an alternative platform that Nigerians can relate to and can see hope that things can change. Because no Nigerian is happy with the current situation, but do not see any hope that it can change in the near future. So something must be done to create that platform and that movement, very similar to, you know, the revolutionary movements without the violence. I'm not a believer in revolutions. But I think, and I was in the U.S. when the last presidential elections took place. I think what Obama did was really a revolution of sorts. And Nigerians must think of a way to do something like that, a mass movement for change. That is domestically. Internationally, I think the international community has a huge role to play in ensuring that in the next election in Nigeria, hundreds of thousands of international observers, not 10, not 20, not 1,000, there should be 100 election observers in each polling booth, okay? Not 2 or 3. If we can get 100 in each polling booth, and there are 142,000 polling booths all over Nigeria, okay, something like that will ensure that the results are recorded. More than 100 stakeholders have the results, because the law requires that the results, you know, the votes be counted at the location, the results announced, and all the parties sign. Now, if we do that with cell phone technology and, you know, everyone in the world could have the results within minutes from every polling booth. And it will then be very difficult to alter the results. But it requires not NDI or IRI going to Nigeria 3 months to the elections and begin to get volunteers. It requires that every organization interested in clean elections in Nigeria to be in Nigeria now and to start training volunteers, to start investing resources in building an electoral monitoring infrastructure. That is what the international community can do. What we have seen in the past is that observers come in a month to the elections and without any deep understanding of the country and the games that politicians play, you know, they get outwitted on elections day and the results get announced and then they write reports condemning the elections and nothing more. If we really want change, that is not the way to do it. The way is to be there, to connect with Nigerian civil society, to ensure that we have hundreds of thousands of election observers in each polling booth to escort the ballot boxes to the collation centers, to be a continuous eye and ear of Nigerians and the world about the elections. And it can be done, because virtually every part of Nigeria is connected to cell phones. 50 million Nigerians have cell phones. So this can be done, but it requires a lot of will. It requires a lot of investment, not the touch-and-go approach of international and domestic observers that we have. This is what I think we can begin with. The change must be forced through the cooperation of Nigerians and friends of Nigeria, because it is very difficult for someone to design a system that will kick him out of office. It is just counterintuitive. It's not human. Of course, there are human beings, saints like Nelson Mandela, that would probably do it, but I have not come across so many such people in Africa and the world. Electricity. Well, I don't believe that there is an organized interest group or some vested interest that is blocking Nigeria's efforts at getting electricity. I think it is just simple incompetence and discontinuities in implementing policies and programs. Because I when I was in charge of the privatization program, we drafted legislation to open up the sector. We met opposition. The electricity union went on strike. You know, we went to court and got them ordered not to go on strike because there was no labor dispute. So we got the law passed. NEPA was going to be unbundled and so on and so forth. But implementing that reform plan suffered all kinds of discontinuities because of personnel changes, because of changes in government. And if you go to the electricity company and ask them what their plans are, they will show you plans that were prepared 20 years ago on how power stations will be built, how transmission infrastructure will be expanded, how distribution investments will be made. The only problem was they were not implemented. So I know that there is a lot of conspiracy theory around Nigeria that there is some mafia, some generator importing mafia that is blocking this. I don't think so. I think it is simple incompetence on the part of public sector managers and the failure of governments to implement a well-thought-out liberalization policy that will replicate what was done in the telecom sector, in the electricity sector. When I was in the Bureau of Public Enterprises, we got the Electricity Power Sector Reform Act passed in 2003. It was drafted by Cameron McKenna from Washington, D.C., working with Nigerian lawyers. The law was passed. President Obasanjo was persuaded not to sign it. It was passed again in 2004, I think, or 2005. By then, he had figured out the problems in electricity and realized that the only way we can solve the problem is to open up the sector for private investment. So he signed it. But implementing it has been quite haphazard. And quite frankly, I think the biggest mafia against electricity production and expansion in Nigeria is the political elite itself. Not any organized private interest group. It's, you know, simply incompetence. I have observed this for 9 years while I was in government, and this was my conclusion. And I think with good leadership and focus, it can be done. And indeed, President Obasanjo, from about 2005, when he figured out that the government cannot solve the problem, began to move in that direction. But from 2007, there has been very little movement. The gas constraint is a big problem. We have the gas. We flare. We are the largest gas flarer in the world, unfortunately. We flare enough gas to generate something like 20,000 megawatts of electricity. But to get the international oil companies or the national oil company to invest in projects of gas gathering and distribution requires that the price of gas be right. The price is not right. So it has constrained investments. The international oil companies don't want to do it. The NNPC doesn't have the resources to do it. So we have this gas all over the place, and it has not been the investments to gather the gas, clean it, dry it, and pipe it to wherever it is needed has been a problem. And I know Professor Enaji. He's a good friend of mine, and we worked together on many projects. In fact, he was to do that power plant in Abuja, but we don't have gas. And I tried to get an investment to pipe gas from Ajakuta, 300 kilometers away, and it just didn't work. So he went to Aba to do that. So what I'm trying to say is that most of these problems are due to incompetent management, sometimes bad leadership, and this very bad Nigerian habit of each government undoing the work of the previous government. This is a big problem. Every government comes and the first thing it does is to undo what has been done instead of build on the foundations with any correction that may be necessary. Now, on the new oil reform bill, I must admit that I'm not very familiar with the current bill before. I was a member of the Energy Council, so we started the work, and I am aware of the first draft of the oil sector reform bill, but I am not. I've been busy trying to get my degree at Harvard. They keep us busy there, you know. So I have not been up to date on the contents of this. So I may not be able to help you very much. But the political resistance, based on my experience in the privatization agency, is very generic. Okay, usually you have an organization that is public owned. Okay, there are a series of benefits in public ownership. These legislators and senior officials, you know, benefit by getting their relations employed, procurement contracts. In the case of the oil industry, there are oil lifting contracts. There is a lot of money going around in a gravy train which is cornered by very important people. And they will try to put all kinds of stumbling blocks to this. This is a generic problem, whether it is electricity, telecommunications, electricity, you always have this and you have to skirt through it. So this is my sense of what is going on, but I am not familiar with the details. I hope I have.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you.
Carl, did you want to say anything?
I'd like to, but I don't know if there's...
You know, I don't know about the success of an initiative from here. And certainly, if I lead it, it will fail because I'm a wanted man in Nigeria, as you know. When I get back to Nigeria, I'm likely to be arrested, detained, and all sorts of bad things will happen to me. But I will be going back when I'm ready. I think that the best incentive that will make public leaders or elected officials accountable is the fear of elections in a few years. Okay? The risk that when elections come, you could be voted out. And this is why I think that the key to any kind of accountability in governance is really electoral reform. When an official knows that in 4 years or in 2 years, I'm going to have to face the voters and they have the choice to vote me out. And when they do vote, actually the votes count. That is the attention getter that will make that person steal less and work more. I think any other engagement is just, as they say in game theoretic terms, cheap talk. They will listen. We did a lot of that. We tried to show how important it is to get Nigeria to move like the Asian tigers. Wouldn't you be proud? Wouldn't you? They will listen. They will be polite. But, you know, and as long as they know that in 3 or 4 years they can write the results and declare themselves the winner of the election, they will do what they will. You know, I believe that strongly. Now, you asked a very interesting question, and I would like Nuhu Ribadu, if you know, to come in here. But I do think that the political elite are very rational about what they are doing. They know the main reason why what happened to Nuhu Ribadu happened and what is happening to me is happening is to send a clear message that if you try to change Nigeria's political culture, if you try to do things differently, if you buck the system, you'll pay a very heavy price. And the intention is to discourage young people like you who would look at Ribadu with admiration and say, I will try to do something like that. So should you be scared and try to be safe? Maybe. You have the choice. But will that change the country? Never. So if you care about the country, you have to take certain risks. If I go back to Nigeria, I'm taking some risk. But I'm going back because I don't think that we can fight this system by sitting in Washington and writing articles on the internet. I have to go in there and confront the evil that I think is taking over Nigeria. So we have to have some courage to do it. Nuhu Ribadu is here. But you know what? He has not... Well, I'll let him speak for himself. But the whole idea is that it is all these actions are to scare you. And I don't think you should be scared. I think you should be angry. I think that should propel you to want change in Nigeria and be part of that movement that we need, you know, to effect change. I do not agree with the creation of a Niger Delta ministry. I think it's just a political gesture. I do not think the developing Niger Delta and addressing the issues there are best handled through the instrumentality of another bureaucracy. I think there are enough bureaucracies that can be deployed to solve that problem. Indeed, you know, in the Federal Capital Territory, when I was appointed minister, I had to take the very difficult decision of abolishing the Ministry of the FCT because I realized that I could not run a city using a ministerial bureaucracy. And Niger Delta has far more compelling challenges than the FCT, and the best way to get progress in the Niger Delta, I think, is not through a ministry. But if it makes people happy that they have a minister of Niger Delta, who knows? Maybe it makes sense. I'm not a deeply rooted politician, so I don't know the political capital to begin from that. I have made the point, not just about Obasanjo, but even General Abdusalam Abubakar, who I worked for, that most political leaders in Africa accept reforms, far-reaching reforms, out of necessity. That is not to question their intentions, but just to say that, you know, it is not something they come into office to do, but the circumstances sometimes compel them to accept. But whether they have internalized that and would have done it anyway, I doubt it. And I'm not questioning President Obasanjo's intentions. I think he meant well for Nigeria. He's one of the most patriotic Nigerians I've come across. And I think he did a good job. Merely allowing us to do what we did was quite courageous, as you are beginning to notice. Just to allow the right things to be done by people that are competent is really very difficult for a political leader because you're constantly under pressure to stop things. I mean, Nuribadu can tell you that story about his war against corruption. Yes, President Eradua is someone I've known since 1972. He's like an elder brother of the same family to me, and we played very important roles in assisting him get elected because we thought he was a decent man. He ran his state competently, and he could run Nigeria. The fact that, you know, he was selected by President Obasanjo and presented to us as a fait accompli should also be noted. So it's not like we were involved in selecting Eradua. President Obasanjo just said, this is the person I want to succeed me. And he was not a bad guy, at least so we thought. And we supported him. We worked to get him elected. I didn't do much because in my territory he lost. But, you know, yes, we all did so. No, but having said that, does that mean that after 2 years, we find that we made a mistake, we shouldn't admit it? Or after 2 years, our country is not moving in the right direction, we shouldn't speak out? No, I think that people take decisions based on information at the time. If you have better information, it would be foolish not to review your decision and position. And I have reviewed my position on Eradua. I wrote a long essay on him, which is circulating wildly throughout Nigeria. Two newspapers have serialized it. Someone offered this day money to publish it as an advert because he wanted Nigerians to read that essay. But, you know, this is what I feel. I feel that it is only through speaking out and that we can get some change. Lagos is a very interesting case of the former governor, Bola Tinubu, anointing a successor who was a technocrat and creating a governance structure in which Bola Tinubu continues to handle the politics. He takes care of the politicians and so on, while the governor just focuses on getting things done. And I think it's a good model. I'm not sure it's a sustainable model in the long term, but it's a good model to start. The jury is still out. Governor Fashola has done very well. If I had a chance to talk to him, and I hope to when I get back to Nigeria, I would tell him to get more involved politically, not to repeat our mistakes, because his survival long term depends on him getting involved in the political arena rather than outsourcing that to Bola Tinubu. Because right now he's at the mercy of Tinubu. And unless he gets to the table and be part of the decisions and the processes in the political arena, I don't know whether the arrangement is sustainable. He has done very well. We are very proud of him. And I think Bola Tinubu got it right. He got a good model. We didn't get a similar model at the federal level. Maybe that's what Obasanjo had in mind, but it has not quite worked. I don't know if Nuhu, you want to respond to the young man and maybe inspire him.
Sure. Why don't we turn to you and then to Carl?
Thank you very much. Well, Nuhu Ribadu's name has been going around. I thought I was going to be just quiet and listen to. But thank you very much, and I want to thank all of you, Jennifer, Carl, and my colleague here, Todd Moss. Todd is today we are working with. He made it possible for me to start getting salary for well over, which I have not gotten in the last more than a year. I never realized money is that important until really recently. When I was in the office, I was offered money. I had sacks of money given to me, $10 million, $15 million. An individual offered me $50 million cash. But today, I'm getting $2,000 from people, and I can assure you I'm very, very happy. I really appreciate it. It's something that maybe I shouldn't have said public, but I couldn't just... But my life is completely changed, and it goes to what the gentleman is talking about. We did work. We work honestly in Nigeria, and he's going to explain. There might be no time to talk about generally. Probably when another chance comes, one will be able to say it. When we got into government in 2003, probably I was the only one, a public officer, like what Nasiru said. The others are coming from outside. Some of them probably could even call themselves politicians. But I was the public officer. I was a police officer. I joined the police well over 20 years in Nigeria, believing that probably that was the way to address the problems of our country, that of law and order, do things properly, go the direction of how things are, where things are working, basically because of order, do things properly and correctly. And I thought that police could give me the platform to really do that, and I remained all my life in it. In 2003, I had the chance to join them in government, and I had the chance to talk to Obasanjo. And my belief, and it's still the same thing, unless we start doing things properly and correctly, there will be no chance. This issue about development is a matter of time. We'll get there, but we want to fast-track it. We are faced with problems, difficulties. Today we are the lowest. We are at the bottom in the world. We do not have the basic simple things. Those who we were with have moved really, really fast. And Africa today is where it is, simply because of how we mismanage ourselves. We'll get there. It will take us 100 years, but do we have the luxury of time to wait and continue to be, living on the kindness of others? We could fast-track it by starting to do things properly and correctly. I got into government with that ideas and belief. And like all the difficulties that we face, people do face difficulties all through history. Whether here, Europe, and even if you localize it to Africa, at one point we had difficulty of how to get our own independence. Individuals stepped forward and fought. If you see what happened, for example, in South Africa and the southern part of Africa, when they had difficulties of apartheid, few group of people stood courageously with nothing. And I always want to refer to the story of people like Mandela, village chaps, with nothing, no guns, no money, nothing. But a very strong belief and conviction that we could do it, that it is a problem that had to be solved and confronted by us. No one else could do it. South Africa did not change because of the world pressure or anything. It was because of those people and the little kids in Soweto, those who really led their lives and they were killed, and the world suddenly woke up to the reality of the problem. If you see the story of people like Mandela, they stood up. They said they will fight. A lot of them lost their lives in the course of it, but others survived. Few of them survived and saw us through this most horrendous experience of the 20th century, where a group of people, because of their own color, because of what they perceived, dominate others and continue to do what they like with their lives. Today, they succeeded. And it's the same thing like Nigeria. We thought that few people could stand up. The whole problem about corruption, when you're talking about whether it's Niger Delta, electricity, I wanted to talk a little bit about that as well. But this issue of corruption, mismanagement, this crude, primitive mismanagement, the resources that we have is being diverted and used negatively. We just have one resources. It could come from whether it our natural resources, our human resources, or even aids coming from outside. Instead of it being used to solve our own problems, it's now taken out into a negative use, into wrong hands. It brought us bad name, bad image. We will not be able to have all the facilities, infrastructures. Electricity failed in Nigeria simply because of corruption, no more, no less. And I can even give you the recent history of what happened from 2000 when the gentleman said he met her. He went, what happened? Look at it. First and foremost, up to 2000, we probably might have spent over $40 billion on electricity in Nigeria, from the dams that we wanted to do, from the hydroelectric powers that we wanted to, from the infrastructure, the supply network, and so on. At the end of the day, in 2000, and so also when we started the reforms, when the laws, Nasser, I think, was at the center of it, came up with a very good framework upon which we could solve the problem. Then we started seeing changes. Individuals were brought in who changed the whole course of it. And then from that point, we started seeing that they will come to General Electric today and talk about need to get. The next day, they are talking to South Koreans. The next day, Chinese will come in. And then Chinese will be the ones to solve the problem. They will start talking about hydroelectric dam costing $6 billion. Some money will go in. At the end of the day, it will end up not quitting anywhere apart from the few people who are in control, who are in charge, who will take benefit out of it. There are individuals in Nigeria who made as much as $500 to $1 billion from electricity problem in the last 2-3 years. It's a reality. You can never get power. The same thing with the Niger Delta. How can you solve the problem of Niger Delta when those who are in charge of the Niger Delta, and some of them are cases that I handled personally, a governor in Niger Delta who probably got about $1 billion over the 8 years he was in control of Niger Delta, ended up with about $750 million of his own. And that is the gentleman who gave me physical money, $15 million cash. How can you ever solve the problem of Niger Delta? What is the hypocrisy today of going in and kill those little chaps who are demonstrating or who are revolting against the injustice that they see daily? But meanwhile, you are holding the person who is taking the money from him by your own hand and moving in and daily displaying yourself with him. Today, I have seen even those people that we brought to justice, people like the governor of Bayelsa State, we convicted, we've taken billions and billions of money from him. James Ibori will be standing left and right of the leadership of this country. So that is why, and that's why when you said, Nasser, that, well, the solution is going through the military, it's tragedy. I don't want to hear it. I think it's unfair. I think, and you will never get the solution because that's not why the problem is. Finally, to talk about the problem of Africa is the issue about this big office. It's not even big African leader. It's the big office. The offices in Africa, whether it is in Zimbabwe, whether it's in Nigeria, is that one single office determines everything. The leadership, the president, or the prime minister, wherever they are. If you are lucky to have a good person, things may be a little better. And we've seen it happen. For example, the history of Tanzania, Botswana, and the rest, where you had fairly good individuals. You end up getting a bad person in, like Mobutu, and you see the result in Congo. It is the same thing playing out one after the other. People are talking about Ghana today. Ghana simply was lucky. At one point, they had an individual who somehow had the foresight and the ability to put self-interest outside and do things properly for his own country. Jerry Rawlings is responsible for what is happening today in Ghana. He changed it. The individual Jerry Rawlings appointed as head of their own electoral commission is the same individual who is still there, who supervised elections where you see ruling party will lose and give it and hand over to an opposition party. Even by Western standard, that is remarkable. And this is one individual who made it. Problem of Africa, unfortunately, is so simplistic and so but it is issue of people, few group of individuals. In most cases, one individual who could make or mar. Today, Mugabe is in charge of Zimbabwe. No Supreme Court of Zimbabwe can ever issue anything. No any legislature in Zimbabwe will be able to. Nothing. It is one person and one person. Today in Nigeria, I can assure you, it's the same thing. We have one person, and we've seen it between Obasanjo and the person who is. Well, there are so much that I think I'll have to keep quiet here.
We will invite you back at some point, too. Thank you for that. Let's turn to Carla Van. I think you wanted to say one thing on the political. We've got just two more minutes, and give Carl the last word.
Okay. I'll try to talk fast. It's tough to follow up those comments, though. A couple of things, I especially want to talk about the political reform dimension and maybe some things that are changing that might inform how we get to political reform. You know, one is that because the economy depends so much on oil prices, you know, the combination of declining oil prices going down and, frankly, the private sector growing a little bit in the last couple of years does change that dynamic politically a little bit. I just got back from Kenya last month, and one of the most interesting things I heard from Kenyans that I talked to and interviewed was, well, one of the factors that actually stopped the violence eventually was people intervening, middle class and business owners intervening and saying, this is bad for our economy. And happening at an elite level. And so maybe there's space for some kind of coalition that would emerge in that way in Nigeria with the interest of political reform. And I think one of the key new members of that coalition would be former politicians. There are a lot of unemployed former politicians in Nigeria. And when I speak to them, they say, I'm not quite sure what to do. And I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about that. I don't know how to get the resources to do this. But there are some well-intentioned people who are looking for something to do, who have real expertise to offer. And I think this could feed the domestic movement that Mr. Elrefi was describing. I mean, in terms of the international community could play a much bigger role in getting to this. But one of the problems is that after 25 years of the election observation, a number of countries, shall we say, around the world have figured out that there's no diplomatic consequences of stealing an election, essentially. So the assistant secretary of state goes to the inauguration instead of the secretary of state. So what? I mean, honestly, and this is something that I think the electoral observation community and industry is really starting to grapple with, is so when an election goes badly, how do we respond? What do we do? There's been virtually no willingness from the United States or from Europe in responding to that with more force once the principles of democracy have been violated. With that in mind, I mean, yes, I think we need to send electoral observation missions a lot earlier, and that is certainly one of the key, I think, lessons of feedback from election observation the last couple of years. But there's also a very strong consensus not to focus on elections as an event or even as a defining feature by themselves of democracy. And this is a point that Obama made very clear in his Cairo speech last week. I think what we could do at a practical level, at least from the international community's perspective, is also to strengthen state-level politics in Nigeria a lot. I think that this is where the lock on the People's Democratic Party is most vulnerable. I think this would also change the nature of a lot of anti-corruption investigations because Ribadu was hampered a good deal based on the political immunity of governors. But if you had more competent state-level assemblies, then the immunity of the governors would frankly be less relevant. And I think that's the point that we need to get to. And if that doesn't sound doable, I have to tell you, I can't believe the progress that the National Assembly has made in the last 10 years. And so capacity building at some abstract level does work. And this gets to the last point, I think, about the gentleman's question about leadership and the importance of linking leadership to performance. Because I think it's absolutely right that what will produce better performances in Nigeria is the threat of electoral defeat. The problem is that without wide-ranging electoral reform, nobody gets defeated. you have one of the highest rates of turnover in Nigeria, in Africa, but nobody's voted out of office. And that's because of the tremendous authority that the political parties and the PDP in particular has over candidate selection. Everybody knows this, and lots of those former politicians I referred to know this and understand this. And frankly, it has cost them, because what they end up doing is paying thousands or even millions of naira in court battles because they wanted to stay in office, because they wanted to stay on the ballot and put their record of performance to the test. In 1999, 82% of the Nigerian National Assembly had never held public office before. Now, only about a dozen members of the National Assembly are from that class. Now, that gap, those 348 or so members of the National Assembly who are missing, are not there because they were defeated. They're not there because they were threatened and they were cajoled and they were forced out. So that's why electoral reform is so important to getting accountability that will hold, that will eventually improve performance.
Thank you. Great.